The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Yesterday, we introduced a very different notion, I think, for most people about our relationship to Hashem, to God. And that the essential name for the divine in Judaism is the Yud, the He, the Vav, the He. And if we try to understand what that name means, it has two aspects to its meaning. Number one, it suggests the notion of the ultimate is. The was, is, will be. Okay? All religions are an approach to the is. There's Judaism, there is Buddhism, there is Hinduism, but these are all different approaches to the is. Alright? And I'm not right now making any value judgments about it, but that's really what religion is all about. Religion is interested in accessing, bonding with the ultimate is. Alright? And as I mentioned the other day, Hegel, the philosopher, said that the task of philosophy is to articulate, to define that which is. And therefore he went ahead and defined it and said, and that which is reason. In other words, for Hegel, the ultimate essential reality is reason. Everything is a function of reason. Everything is created by reason. Reason would be God then. Okay? But Judaism does not accept that reason is the only aspect to the ultimate is. Alright? There are other aspects the ultimate is. And it's important to appreciate that Judaism is not saying that the task of philosophy is to define that which is, but rather the task of philosophy is to define that who is. Okay? That the ultimate reality is no less a who, no less a personal reality than ourselves, and that reality we call God. In addition, we pointed out that the name, the Yud, the He, the Vav, the He, also suggests something about, so to speak, the essential activity of the divine. And that the word Yud, He, Vav, He is connected to the infinitive word in Hebrew, which is Lihiyot, to be. And therefore, essentially, what is God doing? He is being. That's what He's doing. What does it mean to be? If you're funny and you're being funny, you're expressing, you're manifesting funniness. If you're intelligent and you're being intelligent, then you're manifesting intelligence. If you're intelligent and you're not being intelligent, well then, although you are intelligent, you are not manifesting your intelligence. And therefore, if you're singing, you'd be called a singer. If you're dancing, you'd be called a dancer. If you're being, you'd be called a beer. We pointed out that in fact such a word exists in the Oxford Dictionary. The B-E-R is defined by the Oxford Dictionary as the self, capital S, the self-existent, the great I am. Okay? And that would be perhaps the closest English translation of the word the Yud, the He, the Vav, the He. Alright. This is expressed, this notion that we are all part of divine being, and that being is a verb, that you and I are human beings, spiritual beings, physical beings, animal beings, whatever we are really verbs. There's only one noun, and that's the be-er. Okay? God is not really a being, God is the be-er, and we are beings. Okay? And all of existence is a unified being, an expression of a manifestation of the one beer. Okay. This is expressed in Kabbalah in the metaphor of light. Okay. The Kabbalah starts off with a metaphorical description of life. And it says that all of existence was a simple, endless light. Light is the metaphor for the substance of life. Light. L-I-G-H-T. Okay? That would be what the Kabbalah refers to. We might use the word, in a conceptual way, being, but being is an act of manifestation, an act of revelation. Judaism and Kabbalah speak about divine light. All of existence was a simple, endless divine light, or Ein Sof Pashut in Hebrew. And we really never talk about God, because there's nothing I can say about God. We only talk about God's light. And that's, the Kabbalah only speaks of divine light. Divine light is God as so revealed to me. There's nothing I can say about God, right? But rather, I can only speak of God as so revealed to me. In addition, there's nothing I can say about God in an absolute sense, but rather God is so revealed relative to me. In other words, I can't make an absolute statement about anything in the universe without prefacing that it's still relative to me. All right? Relative to me. And that's what science is demonstrating more and more. That I can't say that's what an atom is, but I can't say that's how an atom is exposed to me. That's how an atom is understood by me. Right? But no longer is science in any way attempting to say this is the way reality is, but rather this is the way reality is revealed to me. Alright? So therefore the metaphor in Kabbalistic thought is that all of existence is a divine light. Alright? And what is the meaning of this light? What is the meaning of this light? There's a very sweet little book called What Do You Mean When You Say God? Alright, there's a woman who traveled the world and she interviewed all kinds of people. You know, religious, not religious, musicians, politicians. I mean, every type of age and profession, religion. And she basically asked, you know, what do you mean when you say God? So one answer in this book was just really, really sharp, really clever. God is like the light in my bedroom. When I turn it on, it lets me see what's there. And this was a 5-year-old girl, right? But from the mouth of babes, it really was a very sharp definition of the notion of the Kabbalistic idea of divine light, okay? Because Judaism says divine light fills everything. What does it mean, divine light? Can you see light? You can't really see light, but what you can see is things in light. All right? It would be a completely different thing. Certain things I can see in the light of God, there are things that I see that I don't see in other light. Okay? So therefore the light of God, the meaning of the light of God is not what I see in terms of the light, but what I see in terms of myself. What I see in terms of the world. In other words, imagine I walk into a store and they have these various flashlights that I could purchase. One is the light of science. Right? And I buy this flashlight, I turn it on, and I point it at my hand. In the light of science, what do I see? In the light of science, I see protoplasm, motorola, you know, I see blood cells, I see. That's the light of science. If I purchase another flashlight that has the light of art, and I look at my hand now in the light of art, what would I see in the light of art? I would see form, I would see colors, I'd see contrast, right? I would see lines. If I got another flashlight, which is the light of, you know, the light of economics, and I flash this light, and I look at my hand in the light of economics, then what would I see? I would see what it's worth. I would know that it's worth about maybe 5 cents, you know, in the chemical market. In other words, depending on what light I look at something, but then there's this other light. It's the divine light. If I had the flashlight with the divine light and I pointed it at my hands, what would I see when I look at my hand in the light of God? I would see the light of God. Right? I would see everything is essentially the light of God. I would see that everything essentially is divine being. All right? And so, all of existence, the Kabbalah says, is really the light of God. Everything exists, participates in some way in this being, in this manifestation of divinity. The Baal Shem Tov teaches that the goal of the human being is to realize that they are a living manifestation of God. And that's what it means to be created in the image of God. Alright? Now, what I'm going to do with you now is to give you an experiential appreciation for these ideas. Because as I mentioned the other day, if you really want to understand this, you can't just approach it with your head. Okay? Certain things cannot be completely understood just in a mental way. Alright? And so what I'm going to share with you now is a piece written by Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook. Rabbi Cook was the first chief rabbi of Israel, actually before the state was proclaimed. And I will be using some of the writings of Rabbi Cook throughout this seminar. Reason being is that Rabbi Cook lived from 1865 to 1935, meaning exactly half of his life was in the 19th century and the other half was in the 20th century. And I have found in his writings a bridge between those two generations. Because some of the questions, a lot of the questions actually, that we are faced with today in contemporary times have to do with that transition. And so many different things were coming into the world on a scientific level, on a psychological level, on a philosophical level, that we need to know what is Judaism's response to these issues. And therefore, the writings of Rav Cook are very important for Jewish philosophy today, because Rav Cook addresses a lot of these issues. All right. Now, it's important to know that Rabbi Cook did not write in English. He wrote in Hebrew. In addition, it is generally understood that he wrote from an inspirational point of view. In other words, in his original manuscripts, they find that he goes off the page a number of times. He was not aware of the page and the borders of the page, so he continued writing onto the table. All right? And they found numerous of his manuscripts that went off the page. All right? Being that he was under the influence of divine inspiration and it would pour down. He's also not, I mean, when you're under that kind of spontaneous downpour, you're not generally aware of grammatical structures, nor are you so concerned with it. And therefore, the difficulty of reading Rav Cook is often his lines are very long and lengthy, and you have to read very carefully so you don't lose, you know, the line of thought, you don't lose the verb, the noun, the subject, you know. And so, now, what I'll be sharing with you is a translation. And that is unfortunate because the translation doesn't really do enough justice to the depth of what he says. Because his unique abilities is not only to convey the content of Judaism, but his particular writing style, just as a poet, has the ability not only to convey a message in terms of what they say, but also how they say it. Okay? And therefore, the how he says it is a bit lost in this translation. And I will try and bring in a little bit more of the sensitivity because I've studied this in Hebrew. But this is called a summons to a higher contemplation. I personally don't like the word summons. It sounds like someone from the court knocking on my door, and then I get a summons to a higher contemplation on Monday, 9 o'clock, and be there. But the true word he used is kriya listaklut elyona, a call to a higher viewing, a higher awareness, okay? Seeing. And why I'm sharing this with you is what Rav Cook is going to share is the experiential implications of the ideas that we developed the other day in terms of what does it mean to live with a consciousness of God as the beer. There is a verse that says, Shaviti Hashem l'negdi tamid. Right? It's a verse that you often see in synagogues. They often put it up front. Sometimes they put it on the Aron HaKodesh, on the Ark. Shaviti Hashem l'negdi tamid means that I put the name, the Yud, the Hey, the Vav, the Hey, in front of me all the time. Okay? What would that mean in terms of my life consciousness, in terms of my life experience? Okay. And this is what this particular piece is. It gives you a sense of the experiential implications of that philosophical idea, so we can better appreciate what the idea means. A summons to a higher contemplation, a call to a higher contemplation, reminds me of an experience that I had walking down Jaffa Street. One day I was walking down Jaffa Street, and I realized that I have my head is kind of fixed in a certain position. In other words, it's either looking straight ahead or down, but I'm not looking up. And I don't know, it's just one of those, well, we talked about this morning, you get this little flash inside that says to you, hey, how come you never look up? You look straight, you look down, but you never look up. So I immediately looked up, and I start walking down Jaffa Street with my head up. And I'm in shock, because I start seeing things that I'd never seen before on Jaffa Street. I mean, I'd walked up and down that street for years. I had never looked up. I didn't even realize that there are trees on the street, right? I thought they were just trunks. I never saw trees. I never saw leaves, all right? I never saw the incredible insignias that are carved out in the buildings. You know, from head level down, then it's really a commercial area with a lot of stores. But if you look up, you'll see beautiful balconies. You see very pretty ledges. You'll see corners of buildings with tremendous ornamentation. I mean, and things that I just never saw because I never looked, right? And that made me realize that that's really how we live our lives. We have a certain perspective on life that becomes very fixed and very rigid, and we miss so much. We just miss so much because that's the way we've seen things, and that's the only way we see things. All right? And so I looked up. I remember I was walking down Jaffa Street with my child. At the time, he was about 7 years old. And he says, look, Abba, a lion with wings. So, you know, sure, sure, kid. You know, let's go. You know, I said, Abba, Abba, a lion with wings, a lion with wings. I said, oh man, the kid didn't get enough sleep today. I mean, what's this kid taking? What's wrong with this kid? He says, Abba, Abba, lion with wings. And he keeps pointing up. So finally I look up, and sure enough, there's a lion with wings. I have lived here for years. I never saw this. On one of the buildings on Jaffa Street, there's this huge lion with wings. You know, this cement statue. I don't even know what it is. I don't know why it's there. But he said there's a lion with wings. I never saw it. There's so many things that we don't see. And so a call to a higher perspective, a call to a higher vision is essential in order to get the full impact of the world that we live in. You know? I always say that we have become so desensitized. We've got Walkmans, Pac-Man, Watchmans. You know, everything keeps us busy and we forgot to see the world. And so a summons to a higher contemplation is just that. It's to open myself up and see much deeper. It's putting on what I would call wide-angle lenses, because most of us are wearing zoom lenses. Right? We zoom in on things. And that's good sometimes too. But the problem with that is it takes things out of proportion. You know, if I have zoom lenses and I zoom in on my hand, I see this tiny little cut. From the perspective of the zoom, I could say, wow! Look at this huge gouge in my hand! But of course, if I take a wide-angle look, all of a sudden I realize, oh, it's just a tiny little cut here. It's a tiny little cut. Perspective is absolutely critical in order to succeed in life. And therefore, very often we have these zoom lenses, and we see the particular, and we don't see it within context. For me, when the Gulf War was going on, it was one of the best times of my life, even though it was a war, and it was really frightening and threatening. But I tell you, when that siren would go off, all of a sudden, you'd see life. You'd see your family. You'd see each other. You'd forget about a lot of stupid things that waste a tremendous amount of time. You'd forget about the bill you have to pay that was giving you such anxiety. All of a sudden, you realize, hey, I'm alive. And so that siren had this ability to just pop me into a much higher perspective on life and things that seem to be so important. all of a sudden we're really very small. And what was really important was really very obvious. Right? But sometimes we get locked into our tunnel vision. We get locked and we don't see what's there. We just simply don't see what's there. So this is a higher contemplation. To open ourselves up to see beyond what we generally see. And I say, I call it putting on the right glasses. You know, if you're wearing blue glasses, everything looks blue. If you're wearing red glasses, everything looks red. Well, I met a couple once that was here in Israel. And it was their first time in Israel. So I said, how's it going? So they said, well, quite frankly, we're disappointed. I said, why are you disappointed? So I said, well, I mean, the restaurants. Ugh. The restaurants. I mean, we've traveled to so many places and the restaurants in Jerusalem are just, ugh. I said, oh yeah, and what else? Well, the hotel. I mean, call that a 5-star, I bet. I couldn't believe it. I was just shocked, appalled. I said, well, have you had a chance to see some of the historic sites of Jerusalem? They said, well, we went to the wall. You know the wall? We went to the wall, and we were really disappointed. I said, why? Well, because it was just, it was just a wall. I mean, you know, it's a wall. I mean, I don't know what we thought. We just thought we'd be more moved, impressed, but we got there, it was just a wall. You have to understand, we're from Manhattan. We see lots of walls, I mean big walls, and very impressive walls, and this was just a wall. So I said, when you came into the country, did you pick up the glasses that they give out at the airport? They said, oh yeah, something free, we missed it. I mean, there were some glasses you get for free? I said, well yeah, these glasses that you really got to get. Because when you put them on, you get to see things that you wouldn't believe is here. So you're like, what? What do you mean? I said, whenever you're traveling, you have to make sure that you're wearing the glasses which is appropriate to where you are. If you are in Italy, you've got to put on Italian glasses to see what's in Italy. If you're wearing Manhattan glasses, you're not going to be happy because it's not Manhattan, it's Italy. When you come to Jerusalem, you've got to look at Jerusalem with Jerusalem eyes, not with Manhattan eyes, right? Because you'll be very, very disappointed. It's like going to Captain EO in Disney World. It's a three-dimensional movie of Michael Jackson. But as you're walking in, you forget to get the plastic glasses, right? That makes it three-dimensional. So you're sitting there in the dark room and all of a sudden there's Michael and he's all distorted, right? And everything just seems so crazy because you're not wearing those glasses, which enables you to see what's really there, and everyone else is getting all excited because, wow, this looks great. And you think like they're all crazy because you look at it and it's all distorted. Try and look at a three-dimensional movie without those, you know, plastic glasses that enables you to see it. So too, a call to a higher contemplation is, there's a way of looking at the world which enables you to see things that you never thought you'd see before. Right? And that's called emunah. Faith. You know, there's a old saying, seeing is believing. But we say believing is seeing. Right? With a certain inner eye, certain insight, you see what you often don't see with your external eyes. But with your internal eyes, you can see. And so this is all about getting ourselves accustomed to, sensitized to, being. Divine being. And so it starts like this. If you will it, man. He didn't really say man. He said human being. And I'll explain why in a second. Observe the light of the divine presence that pervades all existence. Observe the harmony of the heavenly realm, how it pervades every aspect of life, the spiritual and the material, which are before your eyes of flesh and your eyes of spirit. Rav Kook says something very important. He says, if you will it, if you want to see this, you'll see what I'm talking about. If you don't want to see this, you won't see this. Right? Because this is not physical eyes. Physical eyes see it. If it's in front of you, you see it. But if I don't want to see this inner dimension that we're going to talk about, then I won't see it. It's up to my will. And what can I see as a human being? He's addressing us as human beings. He's not addressing us as spiritual masters. He's not addressing us as prophets. He's addressing us as just everyday human beings. Any human being can see this, he's going to tell us. What is that? The light of divine presence that pervades all existence. All existence. If a person wants to see, they will see divine presence. They will see divine presence. You know? There are certain things that you can see. For instance, can you see love? Have you ever seen love? I think you have. But then again, two people are walking down the street, right? Got their arm around each other. And you turn to your friend and you say, look, love. So what are you talking about? Look at that guy. He's choking that poor person. Right? I said, no, he's not choking that person. They're in love. He said, what are you talking about? Right? You see it, right? He doesn't see it. We can see love. We can see warmth. We can see sensitivity. And yet, not with our physical eyes. Most of the things we see are not with our physical eyes. Right? And yet we do see friendship. Right? We do see compassion. Right? I could see a mother embracing her child. And I see compassion. And yet my friend could say, what are you talking about? Look what she's doing. She's squeezing the guy to death. Right? So we do see. We do have an inner eye. We do have a spiritual eye. And we need to train that spiritual eye, because if we don't, we lose it. Right? It's like when you get a new prescription of glasses, you walk out, you go, wow! It was there all along. I just wasn't really sensitive to it. And so he says, listen, all you have to do, you're a human being? Yeah, good, that's it. That qualifies you. If you want to see divine presence, an eternal spiritual reality, which pervades all of existence, you can see it. Observe the harmony of the heavenly realm, how it pervades every aspect of life. You can see heaven permeating earth. You can see it. But again, if you become literal about this, you say, oh yeah, where? Right? But you can't see it. And where do you see heaven? Where do you see a celestial delight? Right? You see it in every aspect of life. If you want to. Because since every aspect of life is part of that light, is an aspect of that being, then it's there. It's absolutely there. And it pervades every aspect of life. Now here the translator missed a fantastic opportunity. Because Rav Kook didn't say this. Rav Kook says you can see the heavenly realm permeating all cracks and corners of life. And to me that just gives me a better feel. It reminds me of art exhibits. Have you ever seen an art exhibit and you're looking at this picture and it's really incredible? And then you realize that it's a crack in the wall. That this person took a close-up of a crack in the wall. And you say, wow, I didn't know cracks could be so inspirational. I didn't know cracks could be so beautiful. You know? That's the eye of an artist. That's the eye of a photographer. They capture moments. They capture infinite beauty in such minute details, which we can often just step on. He captures that beauty. He captures that wonder. And we need to learn how to do that. Right? Because if we don't, we're going to miss a real great part of life. Right? We're going to miss just so much. We're losing our eyesight, but our spiritual, our inner eyesight. And therefore, this harmony of the heavenly realm pervades every crack and corner, the spiritual and the material. There is no dichotomy in Judaism between spiritual and material. Both the spiritual and the material are being. Right? They are both aspects of divine being, the material and the spiritual. There is no conflict between them, which are before your eyes of flesh and your eyes of spirit. That's it. It's right in front of you. Take a look. All of a sudden, it's, wow. You know, I remember I was walking down the street and I saw this just beautiful flower. It was just so exciting. I just said, gee, I walked down this street so many times, I have yet to take the opportunity to just kind of look at this flower. So I just stood there and looked at this flower. And I was really getting high on this flower, you know. This old lady comes up, and she sees me. She walks past me, but she kind of looks at me, and she's wondering, right? And she sees me looking like this. So finally she comes up to me and says, is everything okay? I said, yeah, great. She says, oh. She waits, she looks, she says, are you looking for your contact lenses or something? I said, no. She said, oh, okay. And she says, what are you looking at? I said, the flower. She goes, oh, another nut. She walks away, you know, like crazy, man. Why not? Why not? It's right there. This higher awareness, this inner seeing, it's right there. Contemplate the wonders of creation, the divine dimension of their being, not as a dim configuration that's presented to you from the distance, but as the reality in which you live. Rav Kook first said, observe. Now he wants to go deeper. Contemplate the wonders of creation, the divine dimension of their being. Creation is incredible. I mean, have you ever looked at some of these books on microscopic photos and compare them to telescopic photos? I mean, it's unbelievable. It's outer space, it's inner space, it's infinity. Right? I take one cell of skin and it's a world. You can keep going deeper and deeper. You think you're, you know, on Star Trek. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so, to contemplate the wonders of creation, but not as a dim configuration presented to you. You know, nowadays, you can go to these cinespheres, and they give you all these experiences only for $3. You know, like, now you're underwater. Now you're flying in the air. Now you're on a roller coaster. But you're not. It's a dim configuration. Nothing could compare. Have you ever been with somebody you're looking at something that's just absolutely awesome. The most incredible scene you've ever seen. Right? And your friend looks at you and says, oh, this is amazing. This reminds me of a postcard. I beg your pardon. This reminds you of a postcard? I mean, if a person looked at the postcard, maybe he says, that reminds me of. I can imagine being in the Grand Canyon. I've had the opportunity to fly. I wish I was in the Grand Canyon. But I've had the opportunity to fly over the Grand Canyon numerous times. I'm just overwhelmed. Can you imagine the guy beside me saying, oh, gee, that reminds me of a postcard. That's what happened to us. We lost touch with reality. The postcard could never capture it. Because there's so much more there, even though it's a picture, technically they're the same, but my eyes see much more. My eyes touch much more. I have to learn not to see the world with my eyes, but to feel the world with my eyes. And you can do it. And you know how you know you can do it? Because I know you have felt someone look at you at least once in your life. I'm sure you've been on a bus, and you felt somebody's looking at you. And you turned around, that person immediately turned around. You can feel somebody's eyes. Because somehow our eyes are not only receiving images, but our eyes are reaching out. There was a Hasidic Rebbe who refused to wear glasses because he didn't want to miss the world. Right? Because he felt the glasses would get in the way of touching the world. Touching the world, learning how to not see or look at the tree, but touch that tree. And through touching that tree, you get in touch with the reality of the tree. It's not a dim configuration. You get in touch with that inner dimension, that it's a tree, but it's much, much more. How many times have I seen tourists come to Jerusalem and they have this video glued to their eye? You know, and they're walking down the stairs. This guy's walking down the stairs towards the hotel. Right? His wife's saying, "Come on, George, come on, let's go, let's go." "No, no, sweetheart. I don't want to miss anything. Oh, this is the greatest thing. I can't wait till we can see this in full color on the television set back home. It's going to be great. We're going to be able to see it on television. Great. Right. Oh, I'm at the coattail right now. Here, I'm putting a note in the coattail. I'm coming in real close. Here's a crunch. Oh my gosh, I broke my video. What? I lose it. What? I mean, did I ever think that what I could get on television is in any way comparable to what I could be seeing right this moment, right here, right now? I lost it. God's being is pure presence. And when you're purely present, then you encounter the pure presence of God. But I'm not fully here because people are so used to looking at the world like it's some dim configuration. As if it's some kind of television set, some movie set. Right? People lost touch with the whole notion of reality. That this is real. Like, I'm breaking up with my girlfriend and I hear music in the background. And I see over the horizon credits going down, you know? Like, hey, this isn't a movie. Take the film off my brain. This is real stuff. This is real. And when I get in touch with not simply looking at the world, but I get in touch with the reality of it, I begin to touch the eternity. I begin to encounter that divine dimension, which is the reality of it. Right? I exist by virtue of God sharing His reality with me. And when I get in touch with reality, not just the table, the color, the texture, but the reality of it, that's what's amazing. Right? Not just my hand, but the reality. I mean, do you believe it? I don't believe it. It's real. We forget to get in touch with that quality of realness. Right? And therefore contemplate the wonders of creation, the divine dimension of their being. But how do you do that? But not as a dim configuration that's presented to you from the distance, but as the reality in which you live. That's the dimension of God that I experience when I encounter reality. All right? Know yourself and your world. Know the meditations of your heart and of every thinker. Find the source of your own life and of the life beyond you, around you, the glorious splendor of the life in which you have your being. So Rav Kook first took us on a fantastic journey outside. Right? I was looking, I was contemplating, and then all of a sudden, he says, now look at yourself. Look at yourself. If you thought that was incredible, wait until you look at yourself. I remember one Friday evening, you know, I like to take that moment, the stairwell going down to the coattail, and just kind of look into outer space. So one evening I was looking into the skies, I was looking at the stars, and I'm really getting off on it. All of a sudden, I see two eyes peering at me. I tell you, I was shook up. And I realized it was the reflection of my eyes in my glasses. And I was really in shock because I realized how my eyeballs are no less infinite than that outer space. And how lurking between the lines of finitude is infinity. And that really shocked me. It's pretty amazing what I see. it's equally amazing the seer who's seeing this. And so know yourself in your world. You know, I just can't believe if a person really knows themselves, they wouldn't believe in God. I don't believe a person who really knows themselves would be satisfied with saying that they're merely a created monkey, an evolved monkey over millions of years. I just can't accept that experientially, you know? No matter how rational one might try to make an argument for it. There's certain things you just know, and something I just know. That when I look in the mirror and I look in my eyeballs, I just can't accept that, oh yeah, I just, you know, just... When I look at my children and I look at human beings, when I get down and play with the kids, I know that this is real, and this is beautiful, and this is important, and this is meaningful. And this isn't just a puff that came into being one moment in time and took millions of years to get to this point. There's certain things you can know. And so, know yourself and your world, know the meditations of your heart and every thinker. Find the source of your own life and the life beyond you. Who's that source? Around you. The glorious splendor of the life in which you have your being. Get in touch with that life quality. The aliveness. That itself is once again an encounter with the divine. And what will happen when a person gets in touch with that? He says, the love that's astir in you, raise it to its basic potency and its noblest beauty. Extend it to all its dimensions, towards every manifestation of the soul that sustains the universe, whose splendor is dimmed only because of the deficiency of the person viewing it. What's this love stuff? I mean, before I was taking this journey into outer space, into inner space, and you know what? I ended up in the same place. That's the mystery. I end up with one root, one source for all being, whether it's outer space being or it's inner space being. But all being is unified according to Judaism. And what is love? Love is an experience of oneness. That's what it really means to be in love. When you experience oneness, that's love. You cannot, Rav Kook says also in another place, you cannot not love the world when you understand. A person who's truly conscious of God is a person who loves all. Because they appreciate that all is a manifestation of God. Not that all is God. As we defined and clarified yesterday, the song is not the singer, the dance is not the dancer. The painting is not the painter, but it is an expression of the painter. It is a masterpiece, which is a piece of the master in my home. Right? That's why people spend so much money on a Picasso, even though they could have gotten a print of it. They don't want a print of it. Because having a Picasso in their home is a masterpiece. It's a piece of the master. They feel a sense of his presence in their home because this is his painting. This is his painting. And therefore, a person who really has a sense of the master will have a sense of the masterpiece. The piece of master that's in everything. Right. That spirit of the master, which is everything. And therefore, love is natural. Love is real. Because it's the most real experience of how everything is unified. And how everything is an expression of this one source, the beer. Look at the lights in their inwardness. Let not the names, the words, the idiom, and the letters confine your soul. They are under your control. You are not under theirs. He's saying, now I want you to go even deeper. Right? I want you to see the world behind the word. Behind the word. Because words filter out the world. How so? How so? We're locked into words. We're locked into words. Children, they have such eyes. It's such a pleasure to watch children see the world. Because they consume the world with their eyes. If you look at the eyes of children as they look at things, they consume it with their eyes. It's absolutely incredible. And there I am walking down the street, and my three-year-old looks up and he says, "Abba!" And of course, the adult cleverly informs the child, "That's a bird. Bird." And the little kid says, "Bird? Yep. You'll see them. They fly up there. Bird." Right? Walking down the street, kid says, "Oh, Abba! See!" "Bird. Told you." Kid looks at you like, "Couldn't be. That couldn't also be a bird. It's so different. I don't see it. Looks like a bird to me." From his perspective, they're not the same. They couldn't be called the same word. How could you do that to that? I mean, the child lives in the world of that. And he's just in a state of marvel. But we lose that marvel. Because we have words. We're smart. We have words. "Yeah, that's a bird. That's a bird. That's a tree. That's a person. No problem. I got it all worked out. And there's something that we lose. One of my teachers explained that a prophet is an adult child. A prophet is an adult child. It's an adult who hasn't lost the openness of children. The Talmud says, what happened to prophecy? The Talmud obviously assumes that there's the conservation of prophecy. Right? There's no new prophecy, no old prophecy. Prophecy must be redistributed. It just doesn't leave the world. So prophecy must exist. But I haven't met any prophets. Where is it? The Talmud says, prophecy now is by children and the insane. Now you say to yourself, what does a prophet, a child, and an insane person have in common? What they have in common is the inhibition to see what's there. And the inhibition to say what they heard, to say what they think, right? That's what it takes. We talked about that openness. Children have that openness. They're not locked yet into the world of definitions. They're not what you call spellbound, bound to the spelling of it. They just see it for what it is, without defining it. And what they see, we've lost. We've lost. I remember David Zeller once shared with me that he was at this this kind of new age experimental college, and they invited Carlos Castaneda to speak, and he walked into the room, and there were all these really hip, wild, unusual individuals with feathers in their hair and, you know, and earrings in different parts of their body, and something really outrageous. And Carlos looked at them. He said, "Oh, you're all really different." And I was like, "Yeah." He said, "I mean, you're not like your parents. You're really a new generation." He says, "Yeah." He said, "Look outside. What do you see?" So they all looked out the window. Said, "A tree." He said, "You see, you're no different than your parents. They would have said the same thing." Right? It's an important teaching. What do I see? What do I see? Okay, now I have to understand, of course, I can't go nuts. I'll call it a tree. But don't think it's a tree. Right? Because it's much more. It's so much more. I don't know what it is. Right? I mean, I look at this. I don't know what this is. We call it a hand. But I don't know what this is. Because it's so incredible. It's so unbelievable. But I call it a hand. I call it a hand. One of the things I realized after the birth of our first child, I mean, God willing, you should have the opportunity to see a birth. Because I tell you, boy, it's shocking. It's awesome. It's just awesome. And I remember the first Friday night we were having a Simchat Bat. You know, you have a celebration. And it was our daughter, our first daughter, and I was holding my daughter and all my students were around. At that moment I said, you know what? God does not become believable until life becomes unbelievable. As long as life is believable, God won't be believable. But once you look at the world and you realize this is unbelievable, that's when God becomes believable. You know? And we're in a world that thinks that by describing, by explaining, we now understand. We don't understand. That doesn't make any sense. And yet, We get trapped in these words and these idioms and these letters, and we forget the essence. We don't meet the essence of life, the divine. We don't meet reality because we've covered up with all these words. Now you have to understand something very important. Judaism loves words. It loves words. It values words. But don't substitute reality with words and words with reality. Words are pointers. Words suggest. But I must meet reality face to face as it's manifest in everything. So don't let these words and idioms control your and confine your soul. Because they are under your control, you're not under theirs. I remember I was walking down the street with my kids and they saw an Arab, you know, with a keffiyeh. So my son said, "Oh, look, Abba, a bride." Right? And I was shocked by that. Because he sees a bride. Right? Now, of course, imagine what a parent could do to that child. A parent could say such horrible things. And a child will be stuck in that image. Like I shared with you, remember last program, I was in this pizzeria, and this little kid says to me, sitting beside me, having his pizza, he couldn't be more than 9, he looks at me and says, "Are you religious?" I say, "Yes." He says, "All religious people are thieves." I said, "I beg your pardon. All religious people are thieves." I said, "How do you know that?" He said, "My mother told me." I said, "Well, you tell your mother that you just met a religious person today in the pizzeria who's not a thief. And all his friends are not thieves." He looked at me and said, "Couldn't be. Couldn't be." That kid is so trapped in a prison of definitions, of stereotypes. And he's not going to meet the world because his mother damaged him with these labels that are so set in stone that he can't meet me anymore. He cannot encounter my essence, the godliness in me, because he's already got this word, dati, religious. Right? And I'm not saying it only happens in that direction. It happens in the other direction too, secular. Oh, now I know. I know nothing. And so it's important. Yes, words are important. We need to communicate. But sometimes words are so abused that we no longer communicate. And so we're walking down the street and my son sees a group of nuns. And he says, "Look, Abba, brides!" I said, "No." But then I thought about it. I said, "Actually, you're right." It's true. They were brides. Okay. So, ascend towards the heights. Actually, remind me, I was walking with my children and we were smelling flowers. Don't get too excited. I don't do this that much. But we were smelling flowers. And so my kid went over to a bush, put his nose up to it. You know, this is not a flower bush. This is, you know, leafy bushes. And he puts his nose to it and goes, "Ah." So I looked at him like, "That doesn't smell. You know, that's a bush." And then I realized, you know, I bet you he smelled something. But I know that flowers smell. And therefore, I've forgotten that other things have fragrance too. Because flower, I'm stuck. And children are not so stuck. And we have to be very careful because on one hand, we have to grow up. On the other hand, we can't lose our eyesight, which is our insight, which is our inner eyes also, that encounters and sees the dimension of reality, of being. And so ascend towards the heights, because you are mighty prowess. You have wings to soar with, wings of mighty eagles. Do not feel them, lest they feel you. Seek for them, and they will at once be ready for you. We are put in this world to fly. We should be flying over here. And yet, what happened to us? You know, you have mighty wings to soar with. Wings! You know, I believe Rav Kook is associating with a story in the Talmud. There's a story in the Talmud. You know, during the Roman times, the Jews were forbidden to practice mitzvot, to practice commandments. Right? So with this Jew, and he's putting on tefillin. You know, tefillin are the black boxes, you know, leather boxes on the head and on the arm. sometimes referred to in English as phylacteries. And I never liked that word. It sounds like something you get in a pharmacy. Just sounds wrong. Tefillin. And so, he's wearing these tefillin. It's forbidden. This Roman soldier sees him with the tefillin, and he runs after him. Hey, Jew, I see what you have. So the Jew's running down the street, and he's pulling off his tefillin, you know? And he gets to a corner, and this Roman soldier has got him trapped in this corner. He says, Jew, I see it. You have tefillin in your hands. I know exactly what you have. Right? He's holding, he's clenching it, and he says, open it, open it. And so the Jew opened it up, and it was a dove, and it flew away. Right? And based on this Talmudic passage, whenever a person puts away their tefillin, right, you're supposed to wrap the straps around it so it looks like a little dove. Right? It looks like little wings. You put on both sides of tefillin, and it looks like this little bird. Okay? Because we believe that mitzvot are wings to fly with. People think it's some kind of burden. Oh, why is God putting this on me? What's his trip? Why do I have to do this? And yet, a person who really understands Judaism, which unfortunately I can't say there's that many, I wish there were more, understands these are wings. These are wings. I could fly with this world. But people get so used to their stuff and so comfortable with their stuff that they've forgotten how much they could spread their wings and how much they could soar in this world and how much they could see. I mean, birds, they've got such a bird's eye view of life. And I've lost that bird's eye view because I don't have the courage to take off and really look from a higher perspective. And therefore, this is connected to his higher contemplation. Take off. You've got these wings. They're mighty wings. It's like eagles. Don't feel them. They'll feel you. You don't use it, you lose it. And I think we've lost it. We've lost it because we've just gotten used to looking at the externalities of life. And not seeing the love, not seeing the beauty, not seeing the eternity, not seeing the compassion, not seeing the reality. All of these are the lights of the divine. The forms that robe reality are precious and holy to us, and especially to all who are limited in their spiritual perception. He wants to qualify, I'm not against the words. I'm just against you getting trapped in the words. Right? It's like, I read an article by a Zen master, and of course I'm not in any way suggesting I have a full understanding of Zen. But this particular master said this. He said, once you realize the futility of your categorizing mind, you are ready for the higher experience. And this Judaism would not accept, because your categorizing mind is not futile. It's limited, but futile is a very strong word, and I was very taken aback to say that my categorizing mind is futile. That's the only mind I've got. Right? I can understand that my categorizing mind is limited and can be limiting. And I have to know, right? I have to know dimensions. But, come on. That's all I have, is words. Right? I have words. I have to know that words aren't reality. Reality aren't words. But then again, I need a word. I need to talk. The forms that robe reality are precious and holy to us, and especially to all who are limited in their spiritual perception. Right? But always, when we approach a life of enlightenment, we must not swerve from the perspective that light flows from the incomprehensible to the comprehensible by way of emanation from the light of the Ein Sof, the Endless One. It's like, I believe it was John Wheeler, again from Princeton, the scientist, who said, the most incomprehensible fact of life is that it's comprehensible. And that's what makes it incomprehensible. That it does make sense. And that's wild. It's like, I can't understand why is it that some people feel that science has replaced the belief in God. Why? Why? Apparently, I was told that in NASA, they have a very high sensitive microphone that is in outer space. And this microphone is moving in different directions in outer space. And there's a fellow whose job is to sit there listening to the signals it picks up. And basically, all it does all day long is... That's his job, right? What is he waiting for? Imagine one day he's sitting there. One day he's sitting there, and all of a sudden he hears... Beep! 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 I mean, the guy would freak. He'd run out. He'd say, "We have found intelligence! We have there's intelligence out there!" Three consecutive beeps would have blown the world apart in science. Wow! Right? And yet I look at this world. I've got five consecutive fingers. I have 10 consecutive fingers. Doesn't that blow me away? Just because I think I understand it, because I've seen it my whole life, doesn't mean that I understand it. I don't understand it. Right? They talk about miracles. You know, imagine the first time we saw the sun rise. Wouldn't we say, "Oh, what a miracle"? Of course we would. But our friend says, "Oh, it happened yesterday. It's going to happen tomorrow." So we should say, "Oh, what a miracle! Not only does it happen once, but it happens every single day." Why is it when something is consistent, it's all of a sudden nature? And then it's okay. Then it's not interesting. If it would happen once, wow. That would really blow us away. But if it happens over and over again, big deal. It's incomprehensible. The fact that you and I are sitting here and we can talk and we can communicate, we can think, is incomprehensible. It is absolutely unbelievable. And yet we are. You know, and yet we are. They did this, there was a meeting, mathematicians and scientists, and they were trying to deal with the probability of existence, you know. And they talked about, you know, a simple metaphor. If I had a monkey, if I had a room full of monkeys, and they're all sitting there, and in front of them are computers, right, and they're hitting away the keys. What is the probability that through random, these monkeys hitting these keys, what's the probability that they'll come up with a word, a sentence, a paragraph, a chapter? They said basically, a word maybe, but certainly not a sentence. No way. And so they basically said that statistically, it's impossible that we exist. Thank you. Right? It's impossible for us to exist. All right. It's incomprehensible, right? Incomprehensible. But yet we're here. And that's what they said. They said statistically we couldn't exist. But you know what they decided? But we do. And that was the end. But we do? I mean, that should have then be like, I don't know, should start dancing at that point. We do? Like a friend of mine, he works in this engineering company, and they have these incredible high-power microscopes that project the image onto the wall. So one day, they were sitting there, he and a friend, and this bee dies in front of them. So they kind of look at each other, it was kind of strange, it was right in front of them, this bee just like crashed. So my friend looks over to this guy, and he says, "Hey, let's put it under the microscope." I said, "Okay, fine." So they put it under the microscope and they focus in on the eye of the bee. They zoom it onto the wall and the eye of the bee is perfect honeycombs. My friend said when he saw that, he was in absolute shock. He went, "Oh my God!" You know, he was like so overwhelmed by this. And the guy looking at him goes like, "What's the big deal?" You know, like, oh. Says, "Don't you see? Isn't that awesome?" And the guy beside him says, "No, what's so awesome about it?" That's the way it is. You know? Awesomeness. Awesomeness. You know, the Hebrew word for awe is yira, awe. And the Hebrew word to see is lirot. A person should live in a state of radical amazement. Radical amazement. Because it should never, ever cease to amaze me that I exist and you exist and we are here. And so, we can't forget that it's the incomprehensible that's at the very bottom, the very substance, the inner dimension of the comprehensible. And the comprehensible doesn't make it any less. And we are summoned to share in the heavenly delight in all the particularized perceptions which are all included in this universal whole from which all the proliferations of life are engendered. How does a Jew understand the world? How does a Jew understand life? It's an invitation to share, to celebrate being. An invitation to celebrate divine being.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.